G'day, I'm Tristan White, and this is the Think Big, Act Small podcast. This podcast is for business owners and leaders who dream of building a strong, independent, and high-performing team. It's for those of us who are ready to learn the skills, build the confidence, and be supported to become inspiring leaders of our very own dream team. Get ready, it's time to think big and act small. Hello there, Tristan White here, and welcome to episode 97 of the Think Big, Act Small podcast. Hey, thanks for tuning in and thanks for being part of the crew that listens in here most weeks. I really appreciate it. Now, today in episode 97, we're changing direction just a little bit from our typical focus on communication and personal leadership skills. As business owners and leaders, our number one job is to stay in business. Only by being in business can we grow ourselves, grow our teams, and make an impact on the world. Culture is a critical part of growing a strong, purposeful business. Cash, on the other hand, is our oxygen. Without managing cash, we will soon be out of oxygen and out of business. To introduce the important leadership skill of managing cash and profitability in our businesses, we've got an interview with Greg Crabtree. Greg's an accountant, a small business expert, and the author of two books to help us entrepreneurs run more sustainable businesses. I first met Greg in 2014 when he spoke at an entrepreneurial master's program that I was attending at an MIT campus near Boston in the USA. Greg's work really resonated with me back in that classroom because at the time I had long struggled with growing our business, creating a strong team culture, and building a profitable organization. Greg's approach to helping us business owners understand our businesses, understand our numbers in a simple way, it helped create more certainty, more confidence, and ultimately help me and helps other people build businesses that are both attractive to keep and attractive to sell if selling was something that we ever chose. In the interview, Greg and I cover his personal and professional story, along with a handful of practical tools and ideas from his first book, Simple Numbers, Straight Talk, Big Profits. This is an important episode. It's also a pretty heavy and technical episode at times. I encourage you to listen in closely, but don't try and retain all the info straight away. There's a lot in here. I recommend you listen to all four parts of Greg's approach and then consider applying just one as a starting point. I personally started using his idea of a core capital target first, and then I moved on to getting my salary as an owner at an appropriate level a few months after that, and later on I got stuck into the other two parts further down the road. Now there's heaps to learn in the next 40 minutes or so with Greg, but if you're keen for even more and a bit of a shorter summary, Greg and I recorded a quick video after the interview that covers his top tips for getting started with knowing your numbers and creating a more profitable business. That video is in a Facebook group just for you, me, and the crew that listens in here to the Think Big, Act Small podcast. I'd love to see you over there in that group. Check out the video. The link to find it is in the show notes. Alrighty, it's time. Here's the interview with Greg Crabtree. Enjoy. Greg Crabtree, great to have you on the Think Big, Act Small podcast. Excited to have a chat about your personal and professional background, plus the important topics that you do write and speak about. But first things first, what's the Greg Crabtree current story, please?
Well, the current story is about a year and a half ago, I was fortunate enough to merge my practice that I had started in 1986 with a top 20 U.S. accounting firm, Carr, Riggs & Ingram. And so I got to experience what my clients have gone through in that even though I didn't sell my practice, I literally handed them my equity and then I continue on under their process. But it's still, you go through the same process of a sale of a business to even do that. And I was kind of happy that I listened to my own advice and had an advisor to help guide us through that and be an intermediary so that I wasn't negotiating, you know, for myself. But it's been a great move. It really helped validate, you know, the value that we created with our simple numbers concepts. And it's given us a ton of resources, you know, that really help us in times where, you know, our issue is we've been growing rapidly and it's nice to have, you know, a bigger force behind you. The most interesting thing that came out of it is that, as an entrepreneur, I realized that after we merged that I had underperformed for the 30 previous years of my career, because as an entrepreneur, our biggest challenge is we don't hold ourselves accountable. even though I had two partners, I was the majority owner. And as much as you like to tell yourself that you're listening to other people, you kind of do what you want to do. And you do the things that you choose to do instead of holding yourself accountable. And I would probably tell all entrepreneurs that find somebody that you truly can commit to accountability to, because the corporate office, everything that they ask of me, I can't argue with, because these are things that I tell clients to do all the time. Mm-hmm. So it's like, I have no excuse. But the mere fact that I get this annoying report at 6:35 a.m. on the first day of the month of cash exceptions report, which tells me how much work in progress that we should have billed that we didn't bill, how much our accounts receivable were over the triggers that causes them to be exceptions, the monthly P&L that I get held accountable to hit plan. And we're good at hitting plan, so I'm proud of that fact. And plan isn't just beating last year. It's called actually growing, being profitable and growing at a 15% annual growth rate, which is not easy to do in our profession. These are all good things. And, yeah, it's eating your vegetables with no seasoning. It's not one of those fun things to do. But, you know, it makes you better. And I'd say that was the biggest learning. And then my wife's happy that if I get run over by a bus, you know, there's somebody more substantial to pay her what my value would be worth. And so there is a liquidity event, at some point in the future. Don't worry. The good news is I have no intention of ever retiring as long as what goes on between here continues to work. You know, so because I am quite fortunate in that I do enjoy what I get to do working with businesses. And so as long as my brain keeps going, I'm good.
Greg, firstly, congratulations on the merger, and that sounds like a fantastic next step or next generation for your business and for your firm and for your team. And secondly, Greg, we're going to spend some time on you and your leadership journey and your business journey. I was planning on doing that before we dug into the Simple Numbers book that you've written concept. But what you've just written, what you just shared with me there, Greg, about your merger after starting your firm in 1986, it does remind me of what I find on page 175 of Simple Numbers. And at the very back of your book, there is something called the summary, the 14-year overnight success. And in some ways, I think there are some similarities in that story between what you just told me in some ways, Greg. Am I on the right track there?
Well, I think that's the common journey of the entrepreneur, and you can look at a myriad of reasons as to why. We have, when I wrote that story about one of our clients, I don't put the numbers in the book, but it was a phenomenal economic event that went from where that we found him as a client and where he exited at. We've got multiple clients in that 15 to 20 year overnight success range, and ourselves included. And a lot of it was, what is that blocker? What is that thing that keeps you from attaining that success? And we know, from our EO journeys, I mean, it's one of those things that I will tell you hands down. I mean, had I not found the Entrepreneurs Organization in 2001, we wouldn't be talking, and that's for sure. And that was the thing that broke me out of the accountant's mindset, is being in EO and thinking of myself as an entrepreneur. And so no matter what industry you define yourself in, I would challenge you to define yourself as an entrepreneur instead, because you become kind of stuck in industry speak, industry process. My clients that are in all the industries, I challenge them all the time to break out of that industry mindset. Yeah, you got to live within the rules of that profession. There's many days that I wish I didn't have to maintain my CPA license, because it's just the mindless stuff that you have to deal with. It doesn't matter. And, but it is a constraint. It is what it is. But you have to find a way of saying, okay, am I about changing a profession, or am I about being an innovator in my own path? And I'll live within those rules, but I'll still be able to innovate. And that's what we did, is we took the accounting model where most accountants try to figure out how to do consulting after they've done tax returns and bookkeeping and financial statements in their spare time. And we said, no. This is the most important work. We need to figure out how to help you run a better business first. And then, oh, by the way, if you need taxes filed, if you need a financial statement, if you need bookkeeping, we can do those things because we now know exactly what in those things you need. We talk more clients out of opinion financial statements because they don't need them. Don't tell my accounting friends I said that, or especially my bosses, but they know it. You know, I've even told them. The future of the profession is what we do. And I think this is what the accounting profession should have done starting back in the 70s, and we kind of made a right turn and missed it. But we think that, you know, our highest purpose is built, and this is something I learned from my forum mates in my first EO forum. Mm-hmm. They said, oh, by the way, you see hundreds of people's most intimate financial details. You ought to have, more than anybody, have some idea what works and what doesn't. And that's true. I mean, now, are we looking at that detail to do some mindless financial statement that somebody puts a check mark beside your loan requirement, sticks it in a drawer, and never looks at it? Are we looking at it for the depth of analysis to say, what are the trends of how did you get to here and where do you want to go? And do you need other people's money to get you there, or can you do it on your own money, which I love. And my favorite form of business capitalization is do it out of your own profits. And that way I'm beholden to no one other than the market. You know, so to me, those are the higher purposes. And it just took a while to kind of create our own path, because the current state of generally accepted accounting principles, international financial reporting standards, depending on what part of the world you're succumbed to, I got news for you. Those things don't illuminate financial status. They work for the professionals because those professionals know what all that means, but don't give them credit that they're actually analyzing financial data. Entrepreneurs innately understand the unique handful of three or four things that matter that run their business. And what you'll start to see in the world of financial reporting is people are sticking this data that really is the most important data in the supplemental part of the financials, if they do report on it at all. And that's the essence of telling you how an industry or a business works. And it's not, you know, the basic financials that the profession does. There's a need for it. Yeah, it's transference of legal liability, you know, somebody literally doing the numbers correctly. But don't confuse that data with that data being analytical. And don't think that that data is going to help you run a business. I was talking to a client this morning, and their opinion financial statements for the calendar ended, you know, at the end of the year, they got in August. How analytical is that to where it takes you until August to get financial information on an opinion financial report? That's not going to help you run a business.
It's Greg, you've taught me many things from afar, and ever since we first met in EMP all those years ago. But knowing what you need and getting it quickly and accurately is a critical concept. And the work from your book, and also your work, which is part of Scaling Up from Vern Harnish, is a fantastic combination of how us entrepreneurs can understand what we need and then get it quickly. So I love that distinction. I love the story of your firm, living your own experience, Greg, is just fantastic news. So congratulations again. Let's get into your story just a little bit. Tell us the backstory, Greg. You're obviously an accountant. Tell us about the early career dreams, becoming an accountant, and then starting your firm. I'd love to know just a little bit about that story, if you could, please.
Well, it starts with when you're a kid on a chicken farm gathering 7,000 to 8,000 eggs a day and hoeing cotton in the afternoon when you're not gathering eggs. You look for a job that has an air-conditioned office. and so the accounting sounded good. I had no idea what it did. Endured learning it in college and getting through, getting my first job. And it's like, it wasn't exciting, I can tell you that. But there was something that I was fortunate enough to transfer to a smaller office of the firm I started with. And I had a good mentor as a partner in that office that challenged me and figured out how to kind of get my engine going. And there was just always that, there was something different, you know, and it's like, hard to tell where, why, but to me, there was something in the Well, there's got to be a purpose of why you need to know these things rather than just the filing of a financial statement and the preparing of a tax return. And you know, and I just gravitated to those things, got hired by a bank. That was one of our clients. I did a lot of bank auditing, and that was really where I would probably say more of what I do every day today is more from those 3 years of being a controller and ultimately VP of operations for that bank. In my spare time, I managed a $40 million bond portfolio, and I was pretty good at that. And with no formal training, the numbers just kind of made sense to me in bonds, you know, trading. But it was kind of one of those things that I'm glad I didn't choose that route, because you've just been sitting there staring at a screen making money. And I just love the interacting with people. And so I decided to go out and start my practice. And I took the spreadsheet skills that I developed, you know, first generation PC and spreadsheets back in the old days. Mm-hmm. And, you know, once I got a hold of a spreadsheet, it's kind of like my mind exploded of all of these mundane, crappy things that I was having to do as a staff accountant by hand. Ah, this spreadsheet was wonderful. Mm-hmm. And it was just a mental explosion, and it stayed with me, you know, ever since. And really bringing I was really enamored with how technology could really eliminate useless stuff. And so I don't know, probably a lot of the people that listen to this are familiar with the why assessment. And Jamie Duraghi, a wonderful EO member out of LA, does these why assessments. And of the nine whys, mine is to make a better way. I mean, that's all I exist for. You can tell from the things I've said, I do not suffer useless work. When there's nothing worse than a human effort being expended on useless stuff that just drives me up the wall. And so it's like, put us all in a position to where we can be productive, we can be contributive to society and help people. And really, it's the greatest win-win ever. And I think, you know, as I saw technology and I saw how that could improve and eliminate wasted time effort that just didn't work, It just kind of propelled it. And then had a couple of partners come and go over the years. But really the catalyst was I had a client that I helped launch their business back in 2000. And they moved their offices from Huntsville, Alabama, where I live, and moved to Atlanta. And the founder called me up one day and he said, "Hey, you got to come over and go to the CEO event." And it's like, it was a 4-hour drive. And so, all right, I'll come. And so I come over, joined on the spot. And so anytime an EO member tells me that they have a hard time making forum meetings, it's like, I have no pity for you. Said, I had to drive 4 hours one way to get to forum every month, 4 hours in forum and a 4-hour drive home. I didn't miss a forum meeting for 11 years that I was in that forum. Oh, by the way, in the middle of that time frame, I served on the chapter board that was 4 hours drive away for 4 years. And I served on the EO Global board from 06 to 09 as well during that period. And so it's all about priorities. I still, a lot of times I'll sit on my back porch and have a nice little view off the mountain, you know, where we live, and drink my cup of coffee and think, what would my life have been like without EO? Because I can't even conceive. But the opportunities, I mean, I didn't even have a passport until 2003. Went to my first EO university in Vancouver. I've been to 42 countries since. I presented material off my book in 14 or 15 countries around the world. It's just been an incredible journey that I keep thinking that this is a dream that I'll wake up from eventually, but it's rewarding, you know, to help entrepreneurs and so many stories of people, whether we worked with them I'm just as thrilled with people that read the books and can go make things happen without me ever talking to them. Both are good. I'm good with that.
Greg, that is a fantastic transition from your backstory. We've heard your current story. You also mentioned earlier on in this conversation, you said that when you joined EO, you were challenged to start thinking like an entrepreneur and to think as an entrepreneur, right, as opposed to an accountant. I suspect you were thinking as an accountant before then.
Right. Yeah. I found every way possible to introduce myself using any word other than accountant.
Right. Okay. Got it. But Greg, what I want to ask you, because there's plenty of service-based entrepreneurs who listen to this podcast who may be health professionals, they may be accountants, they may be architects. There's many different professions that listen as service-based entrepreneurs. But many of us, me included, as a physiotherapist by training, often default back to introducing ourselves and thinking of ourselves as that professional. Tell us the learnings that you've worked through and you've come across as you transition from that mindset as an accountant to the mindset of an entrepreneur, Greg.
Well, I think as you look at it, the trap that you fall into is, as a practitioner, you have a job with all the headaches of ownership. And you've got to break through that mindset. And from Michael Gerber's E-Myth to, there was a great article in Wall Street Journal that back in the 90s that talked about a single unit franchisee for Subway franchises, that they said it's a great way to have a $25,000 a year job with all the headaches of ownership. And those things kind of cement in the framework of your thinking to where you go, there's got to be a better way. Mm-hmm. And so when you break the business down, so one of the things that we would always find in our traditional work as an accountant is that I may have the financial statements presented in accordance with generally accepted accounting principles, but they still didn't speak truth. Just think about that. How can you, it meets every principle standard in the world of accounting. But if you have a privately owned enterprise, which is 100% my focus, I don't do any public companies, don't want to do any public companies. If you really focus on a privately held enterprise, it starts with the first book talked about the number one distortion is we play games with owner compensation for ego and taxation. And there's an ego thing of where I want to feel good about my business being profitable. And so I don't take a salary so I can show profitability sooner. Well, that's a lot. I mean, if you got run over by a bus, so you're in the physiotherapy business, who's going to do the therapy on your patients if you don't show up for work? Well, there's people with your skill set. They may be better than you. They may be worse than you. But at the end of the day, there's somebody who can do that. And there's a price that you have to pay those people. That's the job that you have. You can't be a corporate attorney making $500,000 a year and decide to run a bread shop and pay yourself $500,000 a year. That then you can pay yourself what a general manager of a bread shop would make. Mm-hmm. And you've accepted that role as the compensation. So you get paid a salary for what you do. You get a return on what you own. And this is the part that I'm really proud. The second book goes into much more greater detail to win this argument that I've been building with my clients over the years of getting them to understand the number one most valuable asset that you'll ever own is your business. And it has such a phenomenal rate of return that if you run it correctly and pay yourself well for the job that you do, there's no other asset in the marketplace other than, winning the lottery that is going to give you a better return. The minimum acceptable return we believe is 50% in any developed economy. So US, Australia, Canada, I don't know about Europe. Europe's a little iffy. But certainly our clients in Australia, our clients in the US, our clients in Canada, we've not seen anybody who couldn't meet the 50% return standard. And most actually average about 75% to 100% return. So, why wouldn't you continue to nurture and grow and reinvest in an asset that can compound growth at 75% to 100%. Now, there's a point that it runs out, and it's like the bank says, I'm not giving you any more 75% CDs, to invest in, or bonds. And it's like, okay, well then good. I'll find something else to do with that money. But to the extent that they're going to allow me to grow and make that investment, that's enormous. But I've got to have financial data that speaks truth. And we got to quit playing games with ourselves to either make our ego feel good or most of the lame stuff that we do thinking we're saving money on taxes, the damage, the tax would be far less damaging than the damage we do to our business to not have a clear understanding of its performance.
Greg, you've done a fantastic job of explaining that entrepreneur that question, but also starting getting stuck into this simple numbers concept, which is what I really wanted to spend time in the second half of the interview. So one thing you mentioned there was you get paid a salary for what you do, and you get a return on what you own. Now, this is foundational for me. This was really important for me when I first heard you teach this. It's about paying yourself a salary as an employee of the business and building a profitable business that also returns money as the owner. Would you better expand on that concept and then perhaps even give an example of an accounting firm or something like that you could talk us through, please, Greg?
Well, I mean, think of it like this in a sense that it's much more challenging in the producing professions to do this because most producers have this emotional roller coaster that they go through. They start off in their career, they learn their skill set, they move up in value, whether if you're in the medical profession, the accounting profession, legal, architecture, they all work the same way. And when you get to that apex of your career, of when you're the most valuable as a producer, you kind of hit this burnout and you go, gee, I'm really looking for another job. And I'll give you a classic example. So I was doing this project for a plastic surgeon in California. He had four offices. And, you know, plastic surgeon can make $1 million a year in salary working for somebody else to do two surgery days a week, two office days a week, and play golf on Friday. That's the value of a productive plastic surgeon. So this guy, he was a productive plastic surgeon. He had four offices, and you know, but he wanted to run the business. And actually, he was actually an EO member that I met actually through one of the classes in EMP. And it's like, okay, so I said, here's the deal. I said, here's what you got to grow your practice to get to that, to where you're making 10% profitability at a minimum. And I really wanted to be about 15, but 10 was minimum. And it's like, and then, but the practice can only pay you maybe $300,000-$400,000 to be the CEO of a $10 million practice manager. So you're telling me you want to give up $1 million salary as a producer that works 4 days a week to be the business manager that makes less and has to work full time. This doesn't make sense. You know, and so, I mean, he was dead set against it. Okay, well, let's strike a compromise. How about you be a surgeon 1 day a week, one office day a week, and the other 3 days a week, you're the practice manager, and we pay you a $300,000 salary for that. You make $500,000, you know, for the surgery. And so we go through that to get his head around it. But this shows you the idea of thinking differently. And I said, you know, so this guy had a really good lead flow into his business. And so every time somebody came in for a consultation, he had a 60% close rate, but his other doctors had a 35% close rate. And I said, looks like to me, you should be the one doing all the closing. He says, well, that's just not the way it works. I said, who cares? The person is asleep when the surgery is happening. they don't need to be looking at the person who sold them on it, you know, in that profit. And I said, this is the thing that we get into in the professions world. We get into this idea of the book of business mindset. Here's my little practice unit. When you break down any business activity, I'm guaranteeing you that you're working down rate on a lot of those tasks. You're doing things that are not as valuable. So this ties back into why you make a salary as an owner. Are you doing the more valuable things that an owner should do? Are you doing strategy? Are you doing leadership? Are you spending time that an admin could take care of stuff, answering mindless emails, and not really earning your pay? Because I like to challenge my entrepreneurs who like to make a nice salary. Says, well, did you earn it today? And what did you do to go earn that? Because the really running a business is about breaking things down and having, especially in a service-based business economy, which is your audience, you've got to take every service and say, I need the lowest cost person doing the thing of value that matches their cost. And then as I move up rate, then, you know, only the highest cost people are doing the highest value tasks because that justifies their compensation. Once you connect those two things, you now have a business instead of, yeah, I might have a 500 person law firm, but, you know, I got 50 admins and I got 450 people who are running an independent business that are disconnected. What good is that? It's not going to be efficient, I guarantee you.
Yeah. So Greg, I really like that example. So the concept is paying ourselves a salary for what we do, but there needs to be to consider where we're at and where we want to get to. Mm-hmm. There's that transition that often has to happen to get us there. Is that often part of the story, Greg?
Well, it is, but it's also looking at what you're best at. And I'll use my own self for an example. I mean, one of the most important people in our firm is Mike Maxson, who's our before we merged, the term we came up for him was our director of client services. But he's a partner in the new firm with us. But really the way it works is, yeah, I mean, I'm the person that's known from speaking and writing a book, and you know, a couple of other team members are getting known as well, and do some speaking, but I'm the one that does most of it. And so, you know, I feel the customer service need to be responsive, and I like being highly responsive. But when that thing comes in, I'm also doing things like this, and I'm talking to clients and doing some of that work. And my response is to connect that inbound demand with Mike, and then Mike takes it from there. Mike is far better at following through and making those things happen, and it allows that client to get taken care of immediately. He's better at negotiating price than I am, and all those things, and he's extremely valuable at doing it. And so what we were able to come up with is I'm allowed to do the things that, one, I like to do, but two, I'm the most valuable at. And he's doing things that I'm not as good at, and we get distracted and wouldn't be as good at it, and might be too expensive to actually do it, you know, in that regard. And it's really, it's about taking things and breaking it down into its components and saying, you know, matching that cost with effectiveness.
Yeah, understood. Greg, that's fantastic. And that's one of the four keys in the Simple Numbers, the first book, salary for what you do, return on what you own, being the important concept. Now, let's talk about return, Greg, because you've got some, and I think you'll say it better than I do because it's your quote, but something like you're making 5%, you're growing broke or something on those lines. And then you've got the benchmarks you try and get people to work towards. Tell us about that, please.
Well, in the first book, I did it by observation. And so I said, at 5%, you're on life support, 10%, you're break even, at 10%, you're a good business. And at 15%, you're a great business. Take it while you can get it, because the market will compete you back. You know, and the reason why, you know, so I couldn't tell you the why, but I could tell you, we've seen hundreds and hundreds of data sets that's a very good number for any service-based business. There's almost no exceptions to that rule. Based on the research of the Simple Numbers 2.0 book that came out last November, though, I can tell you why now. And largely, it's based on the capitalization requirements of a business. And so what we've learned in the last 10 years is that every business has a different capital signature. So think of it in terms of, do you have receivables? Do you have inventory? Do you have work in progress? Do you have, can you carry some terms with vendors? Do you get advance payments from your customers? You know, do you have delay in certain accrued expenses? It's the net of those things we refer to as trade capital. It's kind of the signature DNA of what makes a highly capitalized business requirement. If somebody, you know, worst business in the world, hopefully nobody's has this, but if you have to carry receivables, carry inventory, and you don't have any support from a vendor to help pay for it, you've got one of the most expensive to capitalize businesses that exist. And it's hard to make enough profit to be able to turn over an effective business, because as those are truly businesses, you grow yourself broke. Every next dollar that you grow in revenue, you're expending probably, some of our clients that have those profiles, roughly 30% of the next $1 million of growth before they get the first dollar, they got to invest $300,000. That doesn't sound like fun. And yet what we've been able to isolate is certain industries have a really low requirement, or what we call cash flow free growth engines. Essentially, your profit is in excess of what your cash investment requirement is. And so we love those businesses because we can coach them up to say, listen, your only impediment to growth is execution. So guess what? I've removed all your excuses. You've got to go prove to the market that you have something they want and you can do it profitably, but cash ain't your problem. And I will tell you, it's amazing how many businesses actually fit that profile. It's probably three times as many as I thought there were in the marketplace. I would say well over half of our clients are in that cash flow free growth zone of where the cash that's required to invest in the next 100,000 in new revenue growth, their profit is higher than that cash investment. So they're cash positive and everything. And what's been amazing is as we've taught them those principles, they learn how to bring the cash requirement down even further and get the profit up. And when you get that magic move going, it's just lovely to see. And people are experiencing success in their business that it's like they never dreamed of. And that's extremely rewarding to see.
And Greg, to put this together with the previous topic we discussed, and that is that this is pay your taxes and may still make a profit goal of at least 10% or going towards 15%, and that includes when you've paid yourself a salary for what you do.
Correct.
Greg, is that correct?
Correct. Absolutely correct. And I'm batting 1,000 on this. I mean, every client that I've gotten to move their pay up to the market wage, they not only got a higher wage, they actually made more money. This is a field of study that if I was going back to college, I would get a degree in behavioral economics. To me, this is the fascinating thing about the power of data that's accurate and truthful, is I can get people to change their behavior if I give them truthful information. And so I would challenge anybody, if you have this mindset today, if you pull out a P&L of your business and a balance sheet, that thing you never look at, and you pull out both of those and say, and you start making excuses of, oh, that number's not right because of this or this. Yeah, you know, we don't book that just yet. We just wait for the end of the year. You got crap as data. I mean, you can't be doing that. You got to have data that's believable. It doesn't have to be perfect, but it's got to be believable and an indication of the true performance of what's actually happening. And it doesn't need to meet the accountant standards. It's got to meet your standard of believability, you know, in that process. And that's just huge.
It's real talk, Greg, isn't it? It's getting to the bottom of what's really going on here and being able to explain it without making excuses. Greg, yep. We've talked about the salary for what you do. We've talked about the profit goal. One other part of your work, which was really powerful for me when I first heard, I've been working hard ever since, is it helps me to feel more confident about the decisions that I'm making and about what's happening in our business. And that's the concept of a core capital target. And because many of us, I think service-based entrepreneurs in startup frames or wherever we're up to, sometimes we only focus on the amount of the bank balance. And there's so much more to that, and we know that. But tell us about the core capital target and how that fits, please, Greg.
It really was a surprise. And like I said, this kind of came from a researching of the data, because when I was writing the first book, I just pulled a sample of our data set of the clients that we had at the time. And I looked back and I said, what's the deepest negative cash flow cycle that a business would have in a 3 to 4 year cycle? And invariably, I mean, the number was 2 months. And that's everything that you don't get terms on. So all labor plus your operating expenses. If you get terms on your cost of goods sold, you don't count COGS, you know, but all labor and all your general operating expenses, it was 2 months of that number. And I said, okay, well, let's start living with that number with clients. And we started using that number in about 2008. And I mean, it's been magical. I mean, and this goes back to the behavioral economics concepts. Because we could give somebody a definitive number that was tailored to their business. It wasn't an opinion. It was a calculated number that scales with, if you get bigger, it gets higher. If you get smaller, it gets lower. But it gave them a number to aim at. And man, it's just been amazing. And it, because they know it, I'm amazed at how many people literally will defend that number to the death now, because they've gotten so used to, you know, $500,000 in the bank account is as if they have no cash. And it's like, and we saw this was vindicated through COVID last year. So in the U.S., we had this thing called the Paycheck Protection Program, where businesses, small businesses got loans. And I was kind of vindicated because the calculation for the Paycheck Protection Program was almost exactly to the penny of my 2 month core capital target number. They had 2 months of payroll plus another half. With that half of payroll is roughly equivalent to your other operating expenses. But it was almost to the penny, the exact same number I'd come up with, you know, for the book. And that was the number of stabilization. And you had a lot of businesses that got to get out of jail free card, you know, that had not been good stewards of their cash. The ones that had been good stewards of their cash got a nice bonus that really has helped spur the U.S. economy, no doubt. So.
Greg, so that's fantastic validation of your work over the years, Greg. And so for a service-based business owner, it is 2 months of cash in the bank to, let's say, revenue stops, let's say a pandemic hits, because it has, or it did. Revenue doesn't come in for 2 months, but we can. You've got 2 months worth of cash in the bank to pay your bills, to get through it, even with no money coming in. Is that the concept?
That is it. Yeah. And that is the, and that cash means I've paid my taxes, so I'm not holding somebody else's money. We've had a few circumstances. I will say this. I mean, there's a few businesses where you get paid in advance and you're holding your customer money. So we will adapt that cash number to be those 2 months of operating expenses plus customer deposits if you get paid a significant amount in advance, you know, because you are held to a standard. I know this sounds weird, but one of the more difficult businesses to manage is where you get paid in advance. Now, it's I love it when you get paid in advance, but you have to be more diligent to make sure that you deliver on what you're committed to delivering and not run out of cash and not lose money and be using the next customer's money to finish up the last thing that you didn't finish up correctly. And so once again, the key is I got to remain profitable. I mean, that's the centerpiece of everything we talk about, and then manage the cash flow of that profitability.
Greg, the fourth part of the fundamentals of your OR system is something called labor efficiency ratio. And and the labor efficiency ratio was, for me, I know it's the glue, and I know it's the most important part, or one of the most important parts, one of the most difficult parts to get my head around and to really understand. And so I think that's potentially a podcast episode on its own. The labor efficiency ratio is a deep one. But I would like to just quickly touch on it if we could. And also, I really liked, I heard you speak, or I saw something you wrote. It was about building a culture around labor efficiency ratio, or around people doing great work. Would you be able to just touch on that concept for us, please, Greg?
So think of it like this, in a sense that, you know, traditional data analysis looks at labor as a cost. It's not a cost. It's a lever. It's a lever of productivity. Name me one business that produces profit that doesn't use labor. Doesn't happen globally.
We've got people in our businesses, Greg, haven't we? That people is where the action happens.
You know, as much as you want to talk about artificial intelligence, it still takes people, you know, to make some of that stuff work. And so what we did is we flipped the formula, and he said, okay, you know, so if you look at, you know, I'm going to get into fractions here. So the denominator is the number on the bottom of the fraction. The numerator is the number on top.
Thank you.
So the denominator is labor. Pick any. You can take all labor. You can take a subset of labor. But let's use all labor. Let's use my simple numbers, the original overall labor efficiency ratio, which is an incredibly valid calculation. Still continues to be. So if I take all labor, what is the numerator that I'm going to hold it accountable to? Because, you know, and this is where I talk about in the book, it ain't revenue. And why is it not revenue? Well, revenue is a slippery snake. You know, as my good friend Alan Milt says all the time, you know, revenue is vanity, profit is sanity, and cash is king. And And you got to take revenue and take one more slice out of it. Now, if you're in a pure services environment with no COGS, I'm just delivering services, then revenue is the number you'll have. But I always leave it to where it's revenue minus cost of goods sold, which may be zero, and get the gross margin, because there's a possibility that I might learn that although it sounds great that I'm doing everything, I might make more money if I actually hire somebody else that's even a contractor to do it instead or do some of it when I have overflow. So those are all reasons why we look at it that way. So the key is looking at gross margin, which is revenue minus cost of goods sold. If I'm a service-based business, most of the time cost of goods sold is only usually one of two components. It's either subcontractors, freelancers, or out-of-pocket expenses for travel, you know, whatever. And so that net number of gross margin is the output of my labor. And so it gives us a clean picture that says for every dollar of labor that I spend, here's the amount of gross margin they need to go produce. Now, let me challenge your audience. Did you get everything done in the month of June that could have gotten done in the month of June, or did you have some stuff that got pushed over into July? The answer is 100%. Nobody gets everything done. Nobody ran out of things to do. Well, guess what? Well, if you'd gotten it done in June, instead of it drifting into July, I would have had more billable value for the labor that was already there. And now it's in the way of the next month that I need to go be productive in as well. And so this mindset continues to be this thing of, you know, I always say labor is it's the only cost that comes to work every day with an attitude. It has good days and it has bad days and a lot of days in between. And it's a variable output engine. It doesn't run at a constant RPMs. And so I've got to find ways, and this is where the culture aspect comes into it. Those people who have good cultures are the ones that can run at a predictable output rate with very little variation. Now, as much as we may love being the hero, it's a deadline. Yes, great. Let's get it out. And then what happens after the heroic event? Everybody standing around the water cooler, having donuts and talking about how great that was. Well, you know, is anything happening? I mean, you're having a little bit of a bonding experience. I get it. But, you know, the thing is businesses are built by around a lot of people. You know, I need the person who's the tortoise, not the hare. You know, the tortoise is the one that makes consistent progress and gets to the end result at a very consistent speed. The hare is the one that flashes and has this great output of performance and then sleeps on the job because they got to rest up. And, well, you know, boy, that was really tough. You know, and then I we all employ all of these kinds of folks. And it's like, I don't really care. I need probably a little bit of both of them, but I need a common way to measure how they compare against each other. Mm-hmm. And the simplest way to do it, whether for the company in total or a team or a person, how much margin did you produce and how much did I pay you? And I don't care if that time was billable or if it was PTO or time off or holiday time or whatever. I paid you a sum of dollars. And this kind of goes into my thing of, you know, measuring anything on a headcount basis is demeaning. I mean, please, 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 please never refer to your employees as a body count because they're unique individuals. Some produce more, some produce less. They all hopefully are all doing meaningful work. But if you want to measure output, it's about gross margin dollars compared to dollars of labor spent. And as you find people in the arc of their career, they're going to produce less at the beginning, and I go invest in them in training and process, and then their productivity will go up, and their pay will chase it. And their productivity will go up, and their pay will chase it. And that's what we call, in the new book, I have a graph in there called the career labor efficiency curve, which you start out in the training phase, and you go to the chasing zone phase. And unfortunately, there's a third phase called the replacement zone, which is where that person runs out of steam and they really can't produce more. And for some reason, they still want pay increases. It's like, well, if you can't produce more, why am I giving you a pay increase? Maybe you need to try something different, and I'll try a different employee. And you'll see this in certain industries that are used to turnover. Long-term industries, we have this idea that we almost treat employees like pets. We expect them to work for us forever. And that's not realistic either, you know, and everybody needs to be able to move to their highest, best value, whether it's with you or whether another company. But at the end of the day, both are good. But it's that clear measure, though, that I think when you look at gross margin as an output number to that wage for the company, for that unit or that person, I think that's the cleanest way of looking at it.
Greg, thank you for explaining that. It's a really, for me anyway, it's a difficult concept to really work with. But I think the four.
Well, in the new book, I will say this: there is a whole chapter just on labor efficiency ratio in the new book. Good, so that good, I did good, good. That's did add that one.
So for everyone that's listening, if it hasn't been clear just yet, Simple Numbers was the first book that Greg first wrote. Simple Numbers: Straight Talk, Big Profits was the mm-hmm. full title. And then there is Simple Numbers 2.0, which has been released in last year, in 2020. And that's the two books we've been referring to. We'll put the links in the show notes so people can follow them. Greg, this has been a fantastic conversation. I'm so pleased that we can get into this important topic. Two last questions before we wrap up this episode. One is, where do we find you online if people would like to follow up and get some more resources? I know you've got some great resources on your website. And secondly, any other stuff or anything else that you thought you wanted to mention but we haven't quite got a chance just yet?
Yeah, simplenumbers.me is the book website. So that's where a lot of the content is, you know, from both books. There's some free downloadable spreadsheets that we put on that site, a few links to some videos and presentations. There's a YouTube channel. Actually, if you search on either Simple Numbers or Greg Crabtree, there's a ton of people who've posted stuff where I've done presentations, and I'm pretty open to let people record them and post them. Several of my talks are out there that are longer form, you know, that goes through slide presentations and those things. So we get a lot of people that, you know, have just seen those and, you know, found them useful. So we've been, you know, our passion is, like I said, it's really, you know, I probably could have done a better job of monetizing it, you know, but, you know, this is a topic that I feel passionate about, that I don't want to create too many barriers. I mean, certainly we got to charge when we do consulting work, you know, we're responsible to, you know, to do that. But really we do like to get the content out there for people to be able to have, you know, relatively easy access to it, because, you know, there's nothing better than seeing an entrepreneur get the results of the risk that you've taken to run a business, no matter what country you're running it in. You know, that it's a fun thing.
Fantastic. Greg Crabtree, thanks for being a guest on the Think Big, Act Small podcast.
Yeah, thanks, Tristan.
Thanks so much for tuning in to the Think Big, Act Small podcast. I really appreciate it. That's it for today's show. But before you go, I've got a quick question for you. Can you think of an inspiring, people-focused leader that you'd love me to interview on the show? Or are you an emerging leader yourself that's building a team of 15 to 50 people that would love to share your story and be coached by me on a future episode? If the answer to either question is yes, then please take a moment to act small and email me, tristan@tristanwhite.com.au. I'd really love to hear from you. But for now, that's it. Until next time, have an awesome day.